The Music Business Worldwide podcast is supported by Volley Music, a leading financial management platform for the music industry. Volley enables you to track expenses, approve invoices, and make payments 24/7, 365 days a year. For your free trial, head to volleymusic.com. That's VOLYmusic.com.
Hello and welcome to Music Business Worldwide's Talking Trends podcast, which, as ever, is supported by Volley Entertainment. My name is Tim Ingham, founder of MBW, and Talking Trends will see us take a peek behind a couple of recent entertainment industry headlines and give you our quick take on them. As ever, I'm delighted to be joined by Los Angeles-based Charlie Datry. Charlie is a music industry veteran, entrepreneur, expert, observer, etc., etc., and the founder of businesses including Datry Songs, CC Music Royalties, and Best Quality M&M. Charlie is an alumni of labels including Def Jam and Columbia, and spent nearly two decades at the company we now know as Disney Music Group, worked with artists including Public Enemy and Queen. And he told me just we began this podcast that he helped create and market over 200 soundtracks at Disney. Charlie, welcome back to Talking Trends. Please grab a topic from recent music business coverage that you would like to discuss and explain why it's grabbed your attention.
Happy to, Tim, and lovely to see and hear you yet again. I want to talk today about Spotify, and a particular question that came to me when there were some criticisms coming in the last week or so, which is, why is everybody always picking on Spotify? And I have actually some thoughts on that I want to talk about, which is partly it's a result of success, in my opinion, which is that Spotify, by basically observing Pirate Bay and evolving that into a legitimate product, answered the question of, well, how do we come up with something that it's obviously desirable for the public to go someplace where all music is available, or nearly all music, or all the things they're interested in? And how do we create something that's actually creates revenue? Because then that persuades these companies, which at the time were quite possibly, there were people arguing that they would not exist, a legitimate business. And they did. And they have benefited from that. They also have the vision. And I like to think that this is partly a result of where they're from, up in the Nordic countries, which were not particularly important music markets prior to their founding this. There's some great things that came out of it. It was a nice platform, but it wasn't like the first market that people would ever talk about. And it was completely saturated with piracy back in those days. They came up with a legitimate product that answered all those questions, that was a reasonable amount of money, and so then went out across the world and spread it across the world in a unique way. There certainly have been, in the physical era, there were certainly physical retailers like the Tower Records of the world, or in America, what became FYE, which was a conglomerate that rolled up a lot of the old regional record chains, or the record stores of the UK. In the Western democracy, you had these deep record stores that served the entirety of the marketplace, from the top 10 hits that move a lot of volume to specialty genres that may not move so much volume, but the entire thing worked as a place where you could go and find a lot of music that you were interested in. Never everything. Spotify was the answer to everything. But as they get bigger and bigger, certain natural events happen. The reality is that the volume business drives the business. All the niche artists and all the niche genres don't drive the business unless you're a specialty retailer, or DSP in modern terms, that serves the small artist, the independent artist, the small genre, where they have a following, but it's not a massive following. And Spotify's built a massive business. So they are vulnerable to being attacked just because they're the big entity. They can't possibly service the sort of creator class, the top end of which is a viable business, as well as they do the major artists, because there's many countries, there are regional differences, and they can't do everything at once. And they can't say that because it doesn't sound good to the very active music consumer slash creative class, but I think it's the truth, and it's the reality of the business, which is why there's legitimate frustration from a lot of your small artists or medium recording artists, and then the creator class who just make things and clutter up the bandwidth of the major DSPs and struggle to get any visibility, although it would be tremendously valuable to them. They don't get the visibility because they can't, because it's a massive, it's the Mississippi River going by, and you want to get a little nice pool for your hip-hop act or your blues act or your Americana act or whoever it might be. And it's very difficult for that to be as visible as this giant river of musical entertainment that's coming down the road. So Spotify becomes the rubric that everybody takes shots at. So my end to that is basically that there is a certain element of it that is inherent with being number one, and they are the number one, but they're not actually the solution for every act and every release. And I don't know that they can solve that. And I think that we need to come up with a solution for these legitimate complaints from the smaller artist and the smaller music project that deserve attention. And they deserve focus so that the audience can focus on what they're about.
One thing I would say to this is I've always wondered about the psychological impact on the independent artist from the units they used to talk about in the sales and download era into streaming, and even now from the early streaming era into a streaming era where we have over 500 million subscribers and we'll be up to a billion, I'm sure, active users soon enough on audio streaming services, if we're not already there, is I always think about that million streams threshold. You're at a dinner party and you say, hey, I'm an independent artist. Oh yeah, would I know you? Well, I've had a million streams of one of my tracks. Wow, like that, what an achievement. But we're reaching a level where monetarily that is to be sniffed at, but it doesn't create much of a reward, certainly not a living one. And that when you understand the economics of Spotify and the fact, to your point, you're talking at such scale, you understand that. But also culturally, I think that's quite sad. And it speaks to maybe wider entertainment cultural issues that the world is going through right now, which is you're either a billion plays or you're nothing really. And I guess where Spotify, if they were interested in fostering a kinder perspective on their business and their brand from, to your point, let's say tens of thousands of artists who are potentially going to build audiences of a reasonable degree, the million streamers, the 2 million streamers, 5 million streamers, I guess that the answer to that is, and it is a phrase we've overused lots, it is super fans. And that's probably why it is on Daniel Ek's agenda, because it is giving those artists the ability or unlocking more commercial opportunity for them from the fans amongst the million streams who love them the most. Because we have had a situation, and we still do to this day, currently have a situation where every stream is worth the same as every other stream. And also every listener is worth the same as every other listener on Spotify. And if they can tweak that, maybe that would be a solution. What do you think?
I absolutely agree. The question would be in the way that, say, The Orchard works for Sony Music. It's if they could come up with a solution. Now, the question would be, are there enough people that would sign up for, say, in America, $15 a month that would say, and if they really service that artist and they really, whether by genre, whether by features, why more content that survives it, which then gives them the ability to pay better. But then the question will be, why wouldn't the major artists of the world, the Taylor Swifts, the Olivia Rodrigos, why wouldn't they say, well, I want that much too? So it's like, how do they pay better, even if they gross better, when their audience is set up right now for a very reasonably priced, lower price structure, lower subscription cost, even free, obviously in the freemium part. So how do you do both businesses at once if you're in that kind of business? Or is it a third party comes up with that if it's a viable business and addresses some of those issues? Because you have to require, it's a lot of bespoke work to create the profile. If you think about it, the way an artist's merch booth works when you go to see an artist in a club, it is a absolutely bespoke presentation of the things that appeal to the super fan. We've got some great new merch. We've got, used to be, at least now, probably still your vinyl and CDs and with an older demo artist, and then the other pieces, and you can sign up for this and you can sign up for a VIP because you've self-selected a group of people that are obviously interested in what this particular artist does. How do you do that on the DSP level? And what are the problems if, say, Spotify, they may have the greatest idea in the world for a super fan package. And how do you do that to make the music part of it, which drives everything, more lucrative to the individual artist the way a $15 CD used to? I don't know immediately. So I think you're onto something, and I don't doubt for a second there are brilliant people there and they could possibly come up with something, but it will take time and effort. And if the profit margin's not there, they're a public company and eventually the financial guys will call them and say, oh, this is very nice, but you're not merely making the profit percentage that we require and we're not going to let you do it anymore.
Well, Charlie, you mentioned her. So this is the second topic that we should talk about on this week's episode, which is Taylor Swift. And as I normally say here, if people don't know, this is what's happened. Well, of course, everyone knows, but I'm going to say it anyway. Taylor Swift has her music is returning to TikTok, particularly the recordings that she controls. That includes the re-recorded albums that she's famously released and her more recent material. And most importantly, her upcoming album, which is out as we record this in a few days, but will be out around the same time that this podcast is published. So April 19th. Obviously, what's important about this is that Universal Music Group, which is, let's say, the distributor and marketer of Taylor Swift's music, that keeps it simple, and also the administrator of her publishing rights. Universal is in, very famously, in a now 2+ month long standoff with TikTok, via which Universal's music has supposedly all been taken down off the service. Now, Taylor Swift breaking ranks with that Universal action tells us many things, and there's lots to talk about. I wrote a piece, which I'm sure some listeners would have read, in reaction to this, which was pointing out that Taylor Swift in the past has stood up to digital services, calling for better general compensation, royalties, etc., for the artist community. Indeed, in 2015, this is the most telling quote of all, she, if you remember, admonished Apple Music because what Apple Music were trying to do around the launch of its service, you'd get a 3-month free trial and then you'd have to pay for your subscription after that. And what Apple wanted to do was not pay the music industry, not pay music rights holders any royalties for the 3-month free trial period. Taylor Swift stood up to this publicly on Tumblr, I think, which kind of ages the quotes I'm about to give you, but that was the platform she chose. And she said, I find it to be shocking, disappointing, completely unlike this historically progressive and generous company. This is the really telling quote here. This is not about me. I'll just skip on here. She said, I can support myself. I have an entire management team, etc. This is about the new artist or band that has just released their first single and will not be paid for its success. This is about the young songwriter who just got his or her first cut. And this is about the producer who works tirelessly to innovate and create. And it is a stark contrast, obviously, that right now we have, all right, the number one motivator for this is Universal's own commercial gain. Let's acknowledge that. But as a knock-on effect to that, you do have this almost strike action from Universal and the artists and the songwriters that are affiliated with Universal, all saying, whether or not they're saying it behind the scenes, publicly saying, we're with you. And you've just seen Ariana Grande have a number one album in the US. And with that album, although there were a few back channels into TikTok with some of the music, officially speaking, that album was not available. It was the recorded music from it was not available. A few things just off this that I didn't write in the article, just off the top of my head. I've had some people knock on my door since publishing this article, which was very, let's be fair, lightly critical, more of an observation on the history of Taylor Swift and the difference in the TikTok situation to the Apple and the Spotify situation before that. People have said, you're going after an artist. And I think that's very unfair. And I'll just defend that point, if I may, before I get into some other interesting things. And this kind of speaks to where we're headed as an industry. Okay, it's been a cardinal rule, really, in certainly trade reporting for some time, and I'm sure in the conversations that we all have, that the artist is rightly untouchable. These are the people who have the creative genius to make the music that actually creates an entire industry. They literally make our world go round. So that is only fair and right. But where it gets difficult in 2024 is when the artist is also the label. Because had this, for example, had this situation been, and I know she's signed directly to Sony now, but it's just a good example. Had this situation been Beggars Group, and let's say previously they joined the Universal quote-unquote strike, and they hadn't put any music on TikTok, but they had a big Adele album coming out, as I say, I know she's not on there anymore, put the Adele album onto TikTok, I would 100% written an article about Beggars Group and my surprise that they had broken ranks with the action that was taking place, certainly in this hypothetical example across the industry, with the aim of trying to get better artist compensation from TikTok. I would have written that without a second thought. And I think there would have been much more trade media coverage of this kind of thing that I wrote had it not been an artist. But I guess what I'm saying is we need to differentiate between Taylor Swift, the artist who makes this music, which is incredibly popular worldwide. Let's be fair and say popularity terms, her artist, Michael Jackson, you can probably pick some, the Beatles, whoever you want to pick, but a true global cultural phenomenon. And Taylor Swift Inc. or Taylor Swift LLC, which is the label who has made a unilateral licensing decision, which goes against that of their industry partners. And that was the first thing I wanted to point out. And I think we're going to see more and more examples of this, be it Bad Bunny Inc. or LLC, or pick another artist, The Weeknd, who has effectively a distribution and marketing relationship with their record label, but can make unilateral decisions. The second point I wanted to make, which is I just found this kind of ironic. Actually, a podcast at Music Business World, I didn't know this till this podcast from Music Business Worldwide came out. I interviewed Milana Rabkin-Lewis, who runs STEM, which is the distribution services company. And she pointed out that a topic we've discussed, HYBE, the Korean music giant, has done a distribution deal with Universal Music Group. And it's a 10-year distribution deal, and it was a big deal. And part of that, they invested in Weverse, which we've talked about. But in the fine print, it was actually in a Billboard article, and it may or may not have been put there by, suggested by Scooter Braun, who may or may not have informed them, because I think there were some original quotes from Scooter in it. It wasn't direct speech. It was a reported fact that HYBE had carved out social media distribution for its music from the distribution deal, which is physical and digital in many territories, with the Universal Music Group. That is interesting primarily because it means that HYBE doesn't have to, as I understand it, HYBE doesn't have to abide by Universal's distribution policy when it comes to Meta and Instagram and TikTok. In other words, HYBE's artists don't have to be restricted by Universal's policy on TikTok. And I just found it interesting that a company that Scooter Braun is involved in that made that announcement 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago as we record this, trying to find my timeline. And then Taylor Swift has effectively done the same thing. She said, I am an entity that is bigger than my distribution agreement. And I want to be able to, clearly, her team have said, we want to be able to have our own social media distribution policies. So I found that very interesting. And the third thing is, I do want to turn the tables here and just see it from her point of view for a second, because I think this is a point that hasn't been made enough in some of the coverage. Taylor Swift's music has been off TikTok, right? So as I remember, Universal's fallout with TikTok went public in late January. I believe it was Grammy week. And then in February, Universal's recorded music catalog came off TikTok. That would have included Taylor Swift's distributed and marketed catalog. And in March, I believe the Universal Music Publishing catalog started to come down. So what I find really interesting about the timeline in the defense of Taylor Swift is at the end of January, there must have been a conversation. Lucian Grange or whoever, Sir Lucian Grange, I should say, or whoever would have called up those flagship artists, those true blockbuster megastars, be it Drake or Taylor Swift or The Weeknd, etc., who are affiliated with Universal, and said, hey, this is what's going on. This is why we're doing it. Are you with us? And presumably those artists would have said, get it, a bit annoying, but we're on board. And or, okay, we need to move our album date out of that to there to ensure that Universal has the leverage it needs, but my personal promo plans aren't affected. And in that scenario, Taylor Swift has given Universal 2 months. And most of us, I think it's fair to say, had, and I wrote this at the time, had two tentpole moments that we were expecting would accelerate a deal to be done, despite the bad blood between Universal and TikTok, that would accelerate them to get back to the table and get the deal done. The first was the takedown of the Universal Music Publishing catalog in March, because as you well know, publishing rights are embedded in songs in which Universal doesn't really even own a majority share of the songwriting, and it gets very messy, and it was going to upset other record labels, and it would upset artists who weren't actually signed to Universal and all of that business. And the second was this April 19th date that Taylor Swift announced at the Grammys. Remember, Universal and TikTok's fallout goes public in Grammy week. A few days later, Taylor Swift gets on stage and says to the world, my album's coming April 19th. Very clear line in the sand. And I think, I would assume that Taylor Swift had the conversation with Universal and maybe said, is 2 months and a bit long enough? I am completely coming up with a hypothetical situation here, but maybe Universal said, that should be long enough for us to teach TikTok a lesson. But TikTok has been so stubborn in its point of view, even though the stats suggest its user engagement has gone down, they have dug their heels in. And so I'm not accusing Taylor Swift of any sort of moral turpitude, but it is a blight on Universal's position in this standoff, 100%. And we'll have to see now, as I wrote in the piece, what this means for the other artists. Because if I'm Billie Eilish with a big album coming in May, it's going to take some very skillful negotiation on the part of Universal, which of course they'd be capable of if Billie Eilish were to stand up and say, why is it one rule for her and one rule for me? And I think that there may be a few of those. So it has definitely damaged Universal's position And Taylor Swift has done it for her own ends. Those are undeniable. But at the same time, I completely appreciate she did give Universal 2 months. And maybe there was an assumption a deal could get done in that time.
Yeah, well, two thoughts from me on that, which is, first of all, I don't think as important and powerful and knowledgeable as the entities that we're talking about are, they can't know everything. And the thing to remember in the United States is that TikTok is a giant battleship at sea that is taking blows from areas they didn't anticipate, including the bipartisan support in the U.S. government in an election year to actually ban the entire product, which is, I don't think anyone would have anticipated that 6 months ago. But you've got two groups in the American government who can't agree about anything except for they hate TikTok and they want to ban it. So there are legal answers. There are reasons to doubt that it would ever happen. But it is not impossible that they could pass a really impactful, for a time being, piece of legislation that is existential for TikTok. So certainly a certain amount of their attention has to be diverted to that. And I don't know how it's affected the negotiation. But in my own history, that when some outside major event affects one of the parties, it inevitably is at a minimum distracting and also can greatly slow down any agreement that might come. But in terms of the other part, I completely agree with you. I actually think that we could probably do a whole podcast on this. But when the artist becomes the record label, and that's the case certainly with Taylor Swift, and becomes the own best media channel for themselves, programming to the social media, which, as you very accurately brought out with Hybe, it becomes both a burden and an opportunity and is a complicating factor, because if you have the ability to drive your own media channels and you have the ability to create the content and you aggregate the audience, you inherently become more powerful in your negotiation. So you get better terms the way Taylor Swift does. It also becomes really important to you because it is your communication device with your audience. You aren't going via a third party, be that DSPs, be that broadcast partners. Those are very important to you, but you've also got this other channel. And so I think that subject has a lot to talk about because it goes back as far as even before the Beatles. I always like to remind people that Louis Prima was going after those rights in 1960. So the reality is, I think that all of these factors are at play and it creates a dynamic situation. And meanwhile, from an artist's point of view, you got a big record coming out and you need to promote it. So a lot happens.
It's just going to be really interesting to see with the Tortured Poets Department. There's an argument to be made that Beyoncé in particular has benefited from Universal stars not being on TikTok, because as there's a thirst for superstars, she gets to fill the void of exposure and discussion on TikTok, that the other superstars who might have been there other for this impasse between Universal and TikTok, they might have been there. And so there's naturally going to be more views and shares, etc., of the superstars that are available and are in the market. And it'll be in.
Absolutely true in the TikTok environment, Tim. But I would also point out that in the same way that dispute happens, it benefits Beyoncé in that way. It also benefits the Snapchats and the Discords of the world and the Reddits, where fans who can't get what they want in TikTok can go and find the other content that they're looking for, whether it's short video, whether it's other content to communicate. So yeah, both sides, there are a lot of different winners and losers in this battle.
Before we knew what we knew about Taylor Swift presumably doing a direct deal with TikTok and cutting Universal out of that discussion, I was expecting the album to be all over the Instagram Reels and all over YouTube Shorts. And as you point out, Snapchat, etc., because to your point, it would have been such a competitive advantage to all of those rivals of TikTok. But hey, it's going to be everywhere. And we'll see if it gets extra special treatment on TikTok. I should imagine it will. Charlie, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you for listening to another episode of Talking Trends.